started.
So thanks for the invitation. So I was told this would be a bit informal and a bit of a mix of audiences, mostly physicists, a few people interested in information, a few mathematicians. So hopefully this talk will be sort of the best of both worlds and not the worst. So what I decided to talk about today is, you know, some recent results that I've obtained in collaboration with a few people, largely Gerard Benarous and Reza Gaisari, about dynamics and rough landscapes. And so we're all used to sort of thinking about dynamics from various statistical physics perspectives, and we know sort of even going back to classical models, the whole thing's about, you know, energy-entropy trade-offs. You know, in classical models, something like Curie-Weiss, the energy-entropy trade-off is just, you know, which well you're in and what height. But in the complex systems many people are interested in, there's sort of a new, sort of an extra entropic effect that you have to take into account, which is the complexity of the landscape, which is just the entropy of the number of states itself. And so, you know, what I decided to talk about today is sort of, you know, two aspects of the rigorous study of dynamics in these kinds of landscapes and how, you know, sort of non-trivial entropic type arguments come into play in understanding different questions. So the first part I'll be talking about Gibbs sampling. So this will be, I think, you know, fairly familiar to definitely some more senior colleagues in statistical physics, and it'll be more about how the mathematics literature is catching up to what was kind of known sort of at a non-rigorous level there. But in the second half of the talk, I'd like to talk about sort of a different kind of energy-entropy trade-off that can come up in the study of these dynamics. And in particular, the idea is going to be understanding energy-entropy trade-offs at the initialization itself, rather than on the whole landscape. And I'll explain what I mean by this in just a bit. But first, I'd like to start out with a fairly sort of simple-sounding question, motivated, at least for me, from a kind of question coming from computer science, or, you know, or statistics. The question would be about Gibbs sampling in high dimensions. And so the question I want to study is, you know, I want to understand, sort of broadly speaking, the behavior of Gibbs sampling, a typical instance of Gibbs sampling in high dimensions. I want to understand when it's hard, when mixing is hard. So what do I mean by, you know, Gibbs sampling in high dimensions? I need to sort of fix something. So I want to study, you know, I have some function, a typical function, and I want to sample from the measure of the form e to the minus beta h, that function, right? Where h is that function. And I need some sort of probability distribution over function. So I'd like to start with some fairly modest assumptions. So one is that this distribution is Gaussian. So this will be a Gaussian random function, and then what I'll do is I'll restrict my attention to sort of two simpler regimes. So I'll be doing Gibbs sampling where the prior is, say, either a binary prior, or, you know, say some sort of uninformative rotationally invariant prior. And so then what I'll want is my random function, you know, we want its law to be rotationally invariant. And then finally, the last thing is I want it to be well defined in all dimensions. And so this is all I'll assume about my distribution. But it turns out there's a sort of a classical theorem of Fourier analysis going back to the 40s, which says that there's actually a very rigid class of such distributions. And, you know, it turns out this is sort of exactly a class of distributions that physicists have also been studying. The elementary objects are homogeneous polynomials of degree p, which, you know, is exactly the sort of p-spin models everyone's familiar with. And the most general, you know, function you can come up with in this class is then a random, is just a mixture of these polynomials. Okay?
The most general C infinity. The most general C infinity function.
Yeah, okay, I think smooth is maybe implicit in this, Tuka?
No, it's not. I mean,
no, it's not. It's the most general Gaussian process that makes sense on all the spheres and satisfy these properties. The smoothness just sort of comes from these.
This the toy model of Mozart and Parisi is defined on, you can define it on the sphere, and when you look at the correlations, it doesn't seem to correspond to those of a polynomial. Am I right? So I don't know where it is that.
Yeah, probably maybe something's either buried in this set of assumptions that doesn't. So sort of rules out this model. Okay. But okay. So I want to understand Gibbs sampling, where the function we're looking at is some sort of random power series, a random polynomial. Okay. And so what I'll do is I'll first focus on the sort of discrete set. So I want to study a random power series, and then I'll just take the uniform distribution on the discrete hypercube. So just plus minus 1 to the n and the counting measure on this. And I want to study the behavior of natural sampling procedures, some sort of local reversible Markov chain. And any sort of member of this class, take Metropolis dynamics, Glauber dynamics. I want them to look at anything that'll satisfy detailed balance and say is either nearest neighbor or has only sort of short range jumps. And the question I'm interested in today is, so there's these coefficients in this power series. These are sort of the things that are free for me to choose. This is what sort of parameterizes the distribution. And so the question I want to ask is, for what, given a choice of these coefficients and given a choice of beta, when is mixing slow? Okay? And so, usually, once you get to this point, there's a little bit of a subtlety that can lead to a disconnect between mathematicians and computers, computer scientists and mathematicians on one side and physicists on the other. So I want to be very clear about what I mean by mixing in this case. So for example, we'll take there's sort of two equivalent notions, at least for the worst case setting that we'll be thinking about. One is the following. What you do is you look over all functions, the worst mean squared error between the expected value of that observable at time t and what's sort of the expectation for the truth. And you want the first time such that this is less than, say, a little bit less than a half. Or alternatively, you can look at the total variation distance between sort of the push forward of your Dirac mass through this evolution and the true distribution. So the thing I want to emphasize here is this notion of mixing is a worst case notion, right? It's the question about, how long do I have to wait such that no matter how terrible of a start I chose, I'm guaranteed mixing.
The infinitesimum is on the position of the Dirac mass. Right?
Yeah, no, so this infimum is over, so there's also, I guess, in here a supremum. There's a maximum here that I left out. So it's the smallest time such that for every initialization, you have this inequality. Mm-hmm. All right. So the first class of results I wanted to mention, I'm not going to state it in full generality. I'll sort of explain sort of the more general picture in a bit. But what you can show is that for any local reversible dynamics, there are two analytical conditions. These are sort of analytical things you can check. That will imply exponentially slow mixing. One of them is the condition RSB. I'll explain what this, and the other one is the condition PRAB. I'll explain what both of these are in a bit. But if you have these two, then you'll have exponentially slow mixing. And as I'll explain later, there's sort of a more general criterion which will imply slow mixing in a broader range of temperatures. But it's just sort of some examples of models to which this apply. Take again your favorite dynamics in discrete or continuous time, and we'll assume that our polynomial is, say, even and has no p is equal to 2 term. Similar results hold for Langevin dynamics on the sphere. One thing I wanted to emphasize in particular is that this will apply to, the Ising p-spin models. At low temperature. So in particular, you'll have exponentially slow mixing for models that are full RSB. So So, okay. So, you know, so what are sort of the key ideas? So what are the sort of, you know, potential obstructions, A, to mixing, and B, to proving mixing? So of course, you know, we have this complex landscape. So you know, sort of simpler moves like trying to focus around regions that you understand well might get complicated, you know, because exactly you have these issues like temperature chaos, where the Gibbs measure, if you change the temperature just a little bit, its support can completely rotate. And what we want is methods that apply regardless of the geometry of the problem, so discrete settings, continuous settings. And in particular, we're looking for some sort of, you know, intrinsic quantities for the Gibbs measure itself that would explain why the, you know, mixing is bad regardless of your choice of dynamics. And so the idea in this case is sort of to think about it in terms of, you know, the difficulty of the landscape itself. So, you know, one way of thinking about this problem is as follows. I have this Markov chain that's evolving around in my state space. Right? And, you know, the objective of this chain is to try to learn the distribution of the underlying space. So, you know, one kind of thing you could try to do is see how well it's learned the whole distribution. But a simpler thing you could try is to just test if it understands certain concepts. Right? You can think about testing this against certain observables. And there's sort of, there are natural entropic obstacles to, you know, understanding the time to equilibrium for, you know, natural entropic obstacles for learning various concepts. And the idea is, of course, just, you know, what you might call a free energy barrier. So, you know, rigorously, what do I mean by a free energy barrier? So a function will have a free energy barrier if the following happens. So you look at the entropy of the set on which that function takes a certain value x. And then you can plot this function as a function of x, this entropy. And we'll say it has a free energy barrier if the following happens. There are two values, a and c, that are separated by a much larger value in between. Right? So in particular, if you're trying to reach equilibrium and you're worried about worst case starts, the idea being that, you know, if you start somewhere at c, in order to reach equilibrium, which would be say a, you have to pay the activation energy cost in this free energy landscape. Right? And so then the difficulty of the landscape, we'll say the k epsilon difficulty of the landscape is the largest free energy barrier over all possible k Lipschitz functions. Yes?
Is it implied that the Markov chain or the family of Markov chains are somehow continuous on this x?
So
continuous in the sense that you are really making small jumps.
Well, so yeah, I mean, so it can be in discrete time and a discrete space, but you know it will be a Markov process that's reversible with respect to nu. But that's sort of all I'm assuming at the moment. But because the jumps are local, presumably you can sort of prove some estimates. Yeah, yeah. So you can't move outside of a neighborhood that's more than, say, polynomial growth in dimension. So an elementary lemma you can prove then is, you know, the mixing time on the exponential scale is like this landscape difficulty to leading order. At least it's lower bounded by this to leading order. And so then, of course, the game is all about trying to control the difficulty of this landscape, trying to find some Lipschitz statistic, which you can prove has a free energy barrier. So in classical models, you know, what would you do, right? You know, this measure mu would be the Gibbs measure, and then you would look at something like in Curie-Weiss would be like the magnetization. Right? But sort of the idea that has arisen, you know, sort of maybe in the nine, you know, maybe going back to sort of the idea of the Rubbega trick is that perhaps to understand the dynamics in these landscapes, you don't really want to understand the free energy landscape of just the Gibbs measure itself. So in particular, the idea we have is that instead of trying to understand the obstruction to mixing for our single walker moving in the landscape, we could think about replicated dynamics. That we could have many independently evolving learners. They aren't talking to each other, but they're moving in the same state space, in the same environment. And then there's another kind of barrier to mixing here, right? You could query some sort of statistic that depends on the locations of all of the walkers. And sort of an elementary argument, which, you know, in the math physics literature is usually called a tensorization argument, would tell you that if you control the landscape difficulty of this replicated space, this will also imply a bound on the time to equilibrium for just this original dynamics. And so then, you know, the idea is, you know, you want to try to find a good function whose large deviation rates you can control. And, you know, this is where it connects to sort of, you know, an important idea in the physics literature, which is called Franz-Parisi potentials. And so in particular, what you're going to do is you're going to try to understand the large deviation rate function for the overlap between your two learners, right? I want to look, I have my learner 1 and learner 2 at time t, and I look at their normalized inner product. And then I want to understand the large deviation principle for this overlap taking on a certain value for two independent draws from this environment. Okay? So this is, you know, this is called the annealed Franz-Parisi potential in the physics literature. And in particular, you know, you can compute this free energy. It'll be given as a sort of very complicated variational problem on the space of probability measures and paths on, you know, monotone paths on positive semi-definite matrices. And this can be made rigorous, you know, using recent progress by Dmitry Panchenko on the free energy for vector spin models. So then the question is, you know, how do you actually, you know, say anything about this complicated variational problem? And this is where these conditions RSB and PREV come in. Right, so of course RSB, as you might have guessed, stands for a replica symmetry breaking. And what it is what we want is that the Parisi distribution has at least two points in its support. Right, because what does this tell you? Well, the points in the support of the Parisi distribution will be zeros of this large deviation rate function. The second condition, PREV, is the condition that one of these points in the support has a positive replicon eigenvalue. Now, what is this? You know, this is, again, some quantity you can compute if you know what the Parisi measure is. And what does this tell you? This positive replicon eigenvalue tells you around that point you have a locally quadratic lower bound on the entropy. And so in particular, you know, if you have these two conditions, the free energy landscape will then look like something like this. You'll have the two zeros, and you have to sort of increase around one of them. So there must be a free energy barrier between the two. So then the next thing you could try to ask for is something about, you know, okay, so I'll fix the model, and then I want to ask how small can I take beta to still have slow mixing? So the last thing would tell you that you would have slow mixing down to the, you know, beta replica symmetry breaking. That is, you'll have slow mixing up to the sort of static glass transition. But then, you know, you expect that you'll have sort of require a much higher temperature for the actual onset of slow mixing. And so in particular, what we were able to prove is that, you know, so more generally, you could ask for a condition which we'll call GFED, which is just that there is some non-monotonicity in this Franz-Parisi potential, the annealed one. And what you can show is that for these p-spin models, for example, the temperature at which you have this non-monotonicity is strictly higher than the replica symmetry breaking one. But again, I want to emphasize that you'll still have a non-monotonicity if you study models which have, at least some models which have full RSB, like easing p-spin models. So that's about all I wanted to say about mixing, but I was told to sort of mention what are sort of the interesting sort of next questions to study that are open right now at the level of mathematics. One of them is about trying to understand the time to equilibrium specifically for the easing SK model. Right, because, you know, we know this PREV condition won't hold because that's exactly sort of the defining property of this Diels-Alder-Tauless line. Another interesting question is, you know, how do you connect, now that we have good understanding of, you know, the complexity in the landscape, you know, there's sort of another sort of geometric approach to trying to do this. Can you actually connect these two? And, you know, we're able to prove, again, also slow mixing results using the complexity, but the question is, can you actually match the temperatures that you would get from these different approaches? And in particular, sort of one other question that I think is sort of really exciting is, you know, so far everything I've been telling you about is a very worst case thing. Something, you know, you're really paranoid about how I start. And, but then, you know, you could ask, well, maybe I do some sort of, you know, nice start, some typical start, you know, something, say, like an infinite temperature, a uniform at random start. Again, in the physics literature, there's, you know, some ideas about how you would understand slow mixing there in terms of Quench-Friends-Parisi potentials. But on the mathematics side, there's sort of very little understanding about how you deal with these, precisely because sort of the classical tools that exist to prove mixing time bounds are sort of really only well suited to proving things about either worst case or starting from the equilibrium measure. And sort of the last question I want to mention, partly because it's going to be the focus of the rest of the talk, is, you know, in particular, you know, what is the role of the initialization, right? These Quench-Friends-Parisi potentials at least have the potential to let us understand mixing, where you start from the Gibbs measure at one temperature but run the dynamics at another. But what happens if I start, you know, initializing at measures that sort of don't necessarily have a natural connection to the thermodynamics? Can you still prove interesting bounds on the time to equilibrium there? So for the rest of the talk, I'd like to focus on, you know, the role of the initialization in these dynamics. And so what I'll do is I'll focus on a specific class of problems coming from inference for tensors that, you know, I think at least half of this audience has worked on at least at some point or is working on right now. But still, let me just sort of remind sort of the rest of the audience what the question is. It has to do with these spike tensor models. And the question is as follows. It's the following question of inference. I'm given a piece of data, which I think of as a tensor of order k in dimension n. And what it is it's a rank 1 object that's been corrupted additively by Gaussian noise. So what do I mean by this? I have some vector that's fixed. I look at the k-fold tensor product of this vector with itself. And then I add to it a tensor whose entries are IID standard Gaussians. So one thing is you already realize there's a bit of a degeneracy, right? Because if I change the norm of this vector, that's like decreasing the variance of the tensor. And so what I'll do is I'll fix these to be standard Gaussians. I'll fix this to be on the unit sphere. And then we'll put in a parameter here, which is a signal-to-noise ratio, which will encode this trade-off between, you know, the signal term V and the noise W. Okay. And the question is, you know, the inference question is, suppose I know lambda, and I'm given y, can I actually infer v? So what do I mean, you know, a bit more precisely? So one thing you might hope for is, you know, what people would call consistent estimation. I would take my, you know, there's the true parameter v, there's the estimate v hat, right? When I say hats, you know, statisticians, they put hats on things, it's not a Fourier transform, it just means the estimator for blank. So, you know, consistent estimation would say, you know, in your asymptotics, the distance between your estimate and the true value goes to zero. But given, say, one observation, this is way too optimistic, right? Because even if you were observing a vector, right, just a linearly corrupted vector, you wouldn't be able to do consistent estimation asymptotically in N for finite signal-to-noise ratios. So sort of the next best thing people hope for is to at least do better than random, right? So what do I mean by this, right? If I pick, I have my favorite vector on the sphere and I pick a random vector on the unit sphere, then the inner product between these two will be 1 on root n, right? So there's a lot of room between 1 on root n, which is a random guess, and 1, which is consistent estimation. And so we'll say the estimator solves the weak recovery problem if at least with overwhelming probability, the inner product between these two is, say, order 1. Okay? And so a question, you know, many people in this audience are interested in is trying to understand, you know, is there a phase transition for the onset of weak recovery? Right? If lambda is 0, there's kind of no hope. And if lambda is infinity, you should be able to solve the problem efficiently. You should be able to solve the problem. For what lambda can you do this? So there are many different ways of, you know, trying to tackle this problem. Sort of the simplest one would be, say, maximum likelihood estimation, or at least a simple one that you might be used to. And, you know, maximum likelihood estimation in this case amounts to the following question. You know, you have your parameter space, which is the sphere dimension n. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to optimize this following function. I have my guess. I look at the k-fold tensor product of my guess with itself. And I look at the inner product between this and the data tensor. Right? And then the MLE will be the maximizer of this function. Okay? So let's just open this up and, you know, see, you know, what are the various terms contributing in this problem? Again, y consisted of two parts, right? There was a rank one term, and then there was the noise. When the two rank one terms hit each other, you'll just get the inner product between the guess and the truth to the power k. This amounts to the population risk in this specific model. And then the other term is, you know, the inner product between the guess and this noise tensor will just be a random homogeneous polynomial of degree k. Right? So in particular, you can recognize this as, you know, it's a competition between a k-spin model and a sort of, you know, ferromagnetic type interaction, but with maybe a higher nonlinearity than something like a Mercury-Weiss model. Okay? And just to sort of make things easier, by rotational invariance, we'll take this vector to just be the North Pole, which is just, you know, the first Euclidean basis vector. So what are we interested in this problem? Let's first think about what happens in the case k is equal to 2, the sort of spike matrix models, which have been studied, you know, going back to the, you know, the 70s in the statistical physics literature, you know, kicked off, you know, by an important work of Ian Johnson in the early 2000s. Sort of the key idea here is this BBP transition, right, which says the following, you know, okay, when the case k is equal to 2, you're given this a rank 1 perturbation of a random matrix. And then the idea is then, you know, the maximum likelihood estimator, you're optimizing a quadratic form. And so in particular, you know, the optimizer will be just the top eigenvector of this random matrix, so it turns into a spectral theory problem. And so what you can show is there's a certain critical lambda such that below this, the spectral theory of the, you know, the random matrix and its rank one perturbation are asymptotically the same. But above this, you know, the top eigenvalue separates from the bulk. And furthermore, the top eigenvector solves this weak recovery problem. Now, the thing I want to emphasize here is that, you know, as soon as it's information theoretically feasible to solve the problem, as soon as you're above lambda critical, right, the spectrum has this nice property that it's dominated by the type eigenvalue. So you know that even something simple like power iteration would be able to find this maximum likelihood estimator, at least in polynomial time. You know, maybe it's not the fastest method, but at least it'll work in polynomial time. But what happens in the tensor case? Well, it turns out, you know, something very dramatic happens in this setting. You have what's called a statistical to computational gap. What you can show is that, you know, the signal-to-noise ratio in this case, for which you can, the maximum likelihood estimator will actually recover the signal, is order 1 in the dimension. But what's expected is sort of for any natural class of algorithms, you require the signal-to-noise ratio to diverge like n to some power in order to be able to efficiently recover the set, you know, the parameter v. And the precise exponent that you get here, at least what's expected, is it depends a bit on what class of methods you're looking at. So one class of methods you could try is some kind of local optimization procedure, something like gradient descent or power iteration. And what's conjectured is that for these methods to work, you need the signal-to-noise ratio to diverge like n to the power k minus 2 over 2. And what's known rigorously, or at least until recently, is that you need it to be like n to the power k minus 1 over 2. On the other hand, you could say, all right, there's such a huge gap here, you know, why am I trying to, you know, compute the maximum likelihood? I just want an estimate. So then I can free my hand up. I can do things like I can look at semi-definite relaxations of the problems. I can start doing spectral tricks by, you know, contracting on various indices. And there, what's known as sort of the optimal exponent is k minus 2 over 4. But the thing I want to draw your attention to is, you know, regardless of whether you look trying to do this local optimization of the log likelihood, or whether you do some sort of relaxation of it, as soon as k is greater than 2, there's a diverging gap between the threshold for estimation, information theoretic estimation, and algorithmic estimation. And so, you know, what I'd like to talk about for the rest of the talk is, you know, what is the mechanism for this gap, right? And how do we understand what's happening here? So one, you know, sort of natural guess would be, again, the complexity of the landscape, right? We know that this is important for all sorts of dynamical questions in these kinds of spin-glass problems. And there's, you know, been a lot, there's a lot of understanding now about how these landscapes look in terms of the complexity of, you know, the problem with without a signal and then with a signal by, you know, many people in this audience. But what we'd like to, you know, propose is that there's actually a much simpler obstacle in this case, which has to do with the strength of the signal where you're initializing the problem. So what do I mean by this? So, okay, let's forget about this Gaussian corruption for a second. And what are we getting access to? We're trying to learn some vector v. But what do we have access to? We query, you know, the person who knows v, and we get that v dot x to a power k. Right? So we get some sort of nonlinear observation of the true vector. So why can this be a problem? Well, let's focus, you know, for the rest of the talk on local methods, something like, you know, gradient descent, power iteration, right? You have to start somewhere for a method like this. And so one thing to do would be to start, say, uniformly at random. So then, okay, you sit down and you draw a picture of the sphere in dimension n, and you say, okay, uniform at random, it's, you know, its correlation with the north pole is like 1 on root n. But then, of course, you know that, you know, this is a completely nonsensical, this, you know, caricature of the sphere in high dimensions, right? The sphere in high dimensions isn't this, you know, nice round surface and the equator being here. All of the mass is here, right? So as far as the dynamics is concerned, it's sitting in this huge flat expanse, which is the region near the equator. And then trying to find this, trying to do weak recovery, what are you trying to do? You're trying to reach a latitude that's order 1. Right? That's a large deviation event. So for you to be able, you know, for you to have a hope of finding this large deviation event, you need the signal to be telling you which way to go. And this is where you can really run into issues, right? Because if the nonlinearity is strong enough, you know, the signal can be damped very strongly near the equator. Right? So in particular, you can do the following sort of simple back of the envelope calculation. You can ask yourself, in the absence of noise, when is there a non-trivial energy entropy trade-off near the equator? Right? So you can look at, you know, the energy scales like x1 to the power k, and the entropy, at least when x is small, scales like minus x squared, right? Or scales like x squared. And so then you see that, you know, if k is less than or equal to 2, the order of this tensor, then you only need a finite lambda for there to be an interesting competition between these two effects. But as soon as k is greater than 2, you need lambda to be diverging in order for the energy term to be able to really fight with the entropy, this minus x squared. So we have these sort of, you know, two options to try to distinguish between. So what we'll do is we'll think about a broader class of optimization problems, which inference problem is just one. And it comes from trying to optimize what we'll call the P plus K models. So what we'll do is the following. We'll look at a P-spin model now, and we'll add to this a ferromagnetic interaction with nonlinearity K. Right, so the first thing is P doesn't have anything to do with K, necessarily. So I've removed this sort of from the inference setting. I'm just thinking about the optimization problem. And the second thing is, you know, k now we can free up to be not necessarily an integer, right? Because, you know, the reason why is, you know, I really want to probe whether or not this exponent 2 is very critical. So I want to probe near 2 plus epsilon, 2 minus epsilon. And so, you know, translated into this setting, the question we want to study is as follows. So we'll take very simple class of dynamics. You could think either say gradient descent or Langevin dynamics. And then we'll initialize this from somewhere, some measure mu. And then the question is as follows. I initialize my dynamics. I run it until some time t. And the question is, how, for a given beta, given temperature, how large does lambda need to be for this process to reach order one latitudes and stay there in polynomial time? Okay? So the reason why I say sort of arbitrary initialization is because, it will turn out the answer to this question will actually depend on how you initialize. So one simple kind of initialization would be to try to do something, say, uniform at random. So, at least what we can prove for uniform and random starts is the following. So I initialize from, say, the volume measure. To avoid issues of parities, we'll condition it on the upper half sphere, right? This is just a probability of half event. And what you can show is the following. For any p, as soon as k is strictly bigger than 2, say 2 plus epsilon, if lambda diverges like n to the power alpha, where alpha is bigger than k minus 2 over 2 plus the 6th, then for any latitude you want to reach, you can get there by a deterministic time t naught, which is order 1, and you'll stay there for all order 1 times, with overwhelming probability in the realization of the data and the dynamics. On the other hand, if k is less than 5/3, you only need a large but finite lambda to get the same thing. So the thing I want to draw your attention to is this. 1/6 and 5/3, these are sort of artifacts of what we can prove, and I'll explain a conjecture that would bring this down to the sort of the true conjecture, the critical threshold that we expect, k minus 2 over 2, and 2 here. But the thing I want to emphasize is p doesn't show up anywhere in either of these two thresholds, right?
Yeah.
In fact, you could go even further. Rather than doing, why stop with p-spin models, you can even do a random power series again and ask, does the threshold change if you have, say, mixtures of p's and q's? But again, these thresholds don't change. So what's sort of the key idea here? So like we said earlier, in the absence of corruption, the whole game was about escaping the equator, right? It was all about, there's a signal that's very weak, but hopefully it just tells you just enough of where to go. And then if you add in sort of the corruption term, however, the landscape starts to get very complex. So one thing you could try to think is, I'm probing, some Hamiltonian that's like h plus lambda phi, right? And I'm taking lambda to be huge. So one thing you could think is, since lambda is so large, there are essentially no critical points above the scale n to the power k minus 2 over 2, and the landscape's essentially flat, and so our dynamic starts above all the problems, and it's in business. So you can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation from the work of, Valentina, Giulio, and Chiara, and Gerard. And what you find is sort of the onset of exponentially many critical points happens at an even larger lambda, which is n to the power k minus 1 over 2. So then you could say, I'm doing some sort of iterative move, right? I don't necessarily care about where the critical points are, but one thing that could really scare me, I could think, is, lambda is so big that the gradient of phi dominates everything. And then you calculate again, when should this be, how large does lambda need to be for this to be true? And again, you'll need lambda to be like n to the power k minus 1 over 2. Right, so the point is, this k minus 1 over 2 threshold is strictly higher than the threshold from the previous slide. But you can already see that it should be some sort of algorithmic threshold, right? Because what is this telling you? Right, below n to the power k minus 1 over 2, you'll have exponentially many, crazy points, points where the signal, the noise is just randomly telling you, hey, the signal's over there and it happens to be right, or hey, the signal's over there and it's clearly wrong. And so, you have exponentially many points where you could start where things are, things are bad, at signal-to-noise ratios that are much higher than what we were expecting from this previous conjecture. So the point I want to emphasize is, when you start talking about these conjectures, it's sort of very important for you to say how you're initializing, right? So then, what is it that I could be gaining from this uniform at random start, right? I have tons of sort of bad starts on the equator. Well, the idea is, again, there can be some sort of an entropic effect, right? The idea being that you gain regularity by randomizing how you initialize. While you have all of these tons and tons of bad points on the equator, a random point you would hope would be just far enough away from these bad points so that as far as it cares, it's effectively solving dynamics in a smooth landscape. So, you know, then there's the question is, you know, how do you calculate this kind of a trade-off, right? A trade-off between the entropy you're gaining from the randomization and the energy which is, you know, measured in terms of some sort of Sobolev norm of the landscape, right? So one way of trying to do this is to try to think about the dynamics as, you know, from, you know, from the perspective of, you know, I think about the landscape as being ambient and I'm just trying to optimize the simple function x1 to the power k in this complicated P-spin model landscape. So one way of doing this sort of change of perspectives analytically is in terms of the infinitesimal generator of the stochastic process. Right, the dynamics, if I take my favorite observable at time t, we know it's, you know, the value time zero plus, you know, a drift term and the diffusive term. And the point, the sort of important term in sort of the initialization phase of the dynamics would be this drift term, right, which is a certain differential operator hitting your observable. Now this operator has two parts. One part is gradient descent in sort of the nice landscape. It's the dynamics we wish we were solving. And the other part is the dynamics is sort of encodes the landscape. One part is gradient descent in this P-spin model. And if you have, if you're doing Langevin dynamics, then there's an extra Laplacian from the Brownian motion. And so then the key idea is going to be understanding how this, you know, differential operator behaves where you initialize the landscape. Because this will measure at least how the particle feels sort of locally where it starts, how smooth it feels like where it started. So, you know, what we do is we introduce sort of a system of conditions that let you measure this kind of trade-off. So we'll say is, you know, a sequence of initializations will satisfy condition 1 to level n. If the first n iterates of this landscape operator hitting the correlation, the probability that any of these are much larger than their natural central limit theorem scaling should go to zero. The other condition, condition 2, is just an anti-concentration statement. It's just saying that a random point won't start literally on the equator. Right? Because why would the equator be bad? Because even if you were just optimizing x1 to the power k, the equator would be a fixed point for the dynamics. But a random start will also be just enough away from this by entropic effects, right? And so you can show sort of, at least abstractly, if you have initial data that satisfy these conditions, you know, condition 1 to level n and condition 2, then as soon as k is strictly bigger than 2, say 2 plus epsilon, you can, you know, get efficient recovery for lambda like n to the power k minus 1 over 2 minus something that depends on n. The point being here that when n is 1, this is the k minus 1 over 2 threshold, which we said was sort of the worst case threshold on the 1 on root n scale. And when n is equal to infinity, this is this conjecture threshold of k minus 2 over 2. On the other hand, if k is less than 2 minus 1 on n, you only need a large but finite lambda to get the same. Okay? So here's some, you know, okay, these are abstract conditions. What are initializations that you can actually check them on? So again, like I was saying earlier, what you can show is that any initialization on the 1 on root n scale will satisfy this condition 1 to level n. Right, all I'm saying here again is, you know, once lambda is above n to the power k minus 1 over 2, you know, as far as the landscape is concerned, it's, you know, even in worst case, it's this nice smooth landscape. What we can prove is that the uniform measure will satisfy condition 1 to level 3 and even level 4, and we conjecture that it will satisfy it to every level. And then one thing is, you know, you might ask if there's an example of initial data that satisfy condition 1 to every level. And it got deleted from the slide, but I'll tell you what it is. It's you just start from a high temperature Gibbs measure for the spin glass model. Right? Remember, you know, this Hamiltonian we were looking at had the P-spin term and the ferromagnetic interaction. So if you just look at the Gibbs measure for the P-spin term, this in some sense has no concept of the North Pole, right? It's uninformed, at least in law. And then you could try to run a very high, you could look at a very high temperature version of this measure and think about dynamics for this. And it turns out the very high temperature spin glass Gibbs measures will satisfy this condition 1 to every level. So I think that's kind of all I wanted to talk about for today. If you're interested more about sort of the details, more than happy to speak offline. I'm here for the next couple of days. But I just wanted to say thanks for listening.
So what you say, the difference between the annealed and the quenched to measure, to prove bounds on the mixing time, is really that the quenched transferring potential is the one that you should use if you start from initial condition.
Yeah, so I'm going to be a bit picky about the word typical, but yeah, so the idea is what these quenched Franz-Parisi potentials will let you do is, you might try to, reach equilibrium for the Gibbs measure at one temperature. At least I think the quenched Franz-Parisi potentials will let you do is bound the time to equilibrium from a Gibbs measure at some temperature that's, say, strictly higher than this. So for example, if you take beta 0, that would be, say, a uniform at random start on your state space. So in that sense, a typical start.
But the question from a naive physicist. When you do the mixing, you really want to know what is the time scale after which you relax exponentially fast, right? As physicists, want to know when the correlation function, let's say, is what is the time to be order epsilon from 0 with the correlation function. The two are the same.
Yeah. So I guess what I'll do is I'll make a distinction between mixing time and relaxation.
Okay.
So mixing. What we mean usually in the math and CS literature is look at all possible observables. And I want to know the time scale such that for all possible observables, this looks effectively as if I were sampling from the Gibbs measure itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is different from just trying to look for very specific observables, or sort of alternatively, very sort of nice initializations that could be more regular than the worst possible start, right?
More initialization.
Yeah, I'm asking for something really worst case, right? Right? And that's why this sort of annealed Franz-Parisi potential becomes important, because it measures these sort of states that are thermodynamically irrelevant but are still sort of metastable states in some sense. And these can be a problem for the dynamics. At least for worst case bounds.
The other thing is that sometimes the correlation function that are interesting for us give you some relaxation time, and then the mixing can be much, much longer.
Right? Yeah.
And do you have a feeling if this is the case for the first case?
I have no idea how to really understand. There are of course very specific observables that we're starting to be able to understand, like energy and gradient and things like this. But for example, how I would even begin to start rigorously proving theorems about quenched Franz-Parisi potential would imply good relaxation from a nice initialization. These the tools in the math literature are really missing for these kinds of questions, because they're really designed for starting from the equilibrium measure for the dynamics.
Because if you are at zero temperature, so say if you do the Franz-Parisi potential at zero temperature, it means you start from the configuration, then and you want to know whether the landscape is going up or not. So you know that if you see a barrier, then in principle, there you're sure that the dynamics.
Sorry, which of the two is at zero temperature? The replica around which you're computing the large deviation, or the measure?
Yeah, imagine that you start from one minimum, then quench one at zero temperature. Then what you would see is that if you see a barrier, then you're sure that the time scale for the dynamics, low temperature dynamics, the scale from this will be exponential.
Yeah, or at least that's what you would expect. Yeah?
Yeah. I didn't appreciate this enough. So,
basically you're saying, so how general is this? If I do an annealed transparency computation and I see that kind of shape, this really implies it exists a worst case condition that will
Yeah, if you have a non-monotonicity, then they're necessarily
exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I
didn't
understand.
On a given instance, because couldn't it be that the annealed is above because there are rare instances?
Well, no. So this is the
or
funny
is it
thing.
A rare, like,
but I mean, you know, almost surely in the environment, the annealed Franz Parisi potential. Almost surely in the environment, right? The annealed in the annealed Franz Parisi potential is just in the Gibbs measure, right? The outer Gibbs measure. Mm-hmm. So this, what I'm saying is almost surely in the environment, you'll have some bad obstacle. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there is some hope for the, I don't know, distant future to bounds on dynamics that are not local so that one can say, and I have a dynamical rule that is applied to any realization of randomness that doesn't contain the randomness as part of the rule, so that I can apply it and make a bound of some kind on how this would perform?
So people definitely analyze non-local dynamics. And there's actually interesting behavior if you allow global versus local rules. So one simple example is the random energy model. So one thing, you know, one way you could think about the random energy model is, you know, you have the measure on the hypercube, and you can think about local dynamics on the hypercube. And this model would have, you know, the dynamical glass transitions at infinite temperature. But you could also say, well, you know, this model is completely IID. So you could just as well just think about it as 2 to the n points, and then at each step I'm randomly picking somewhere else on the cube to jump. So this will also have a dynamical glass transition, but now it'll happen at finite temperature, but still above the Rubbleka symmetry breaking transition. So there are some rigorous results on this. So this has been made rigorous by, I think out of Brazil, Fontes, Isupi, Kayawa and Pierre Picot. So there are results on these sort of non-local dynamics, and we do find that the behavior can be very different. So if you're interested, I can also point you to another paper where, you know, people are interested, yeah? People are also interested in questions about, you know, one other reason why you might be interested in Gibbs sampling is to produce, you know, random graphs. This is one thing people are interested in, producing instances of random graphs. And so it turns out that if you look at local dynamics, non-local dynamics for this, well, the local dynamics will also have some sort of dynamically slow phase at low enough temperatures. But there are certain interesting non-local dynamics where you'll have fast mixing and then slow mixing, but then once you decrease the temperature even more, you'll have fast mixing again. So what's going on when you have non-local moves, I think, is it's a very interesting question. And there's a lot to explore there. And I think there are tools there, again, for studying kinds of worst-case questions, again, or starting from the equilibrium measure. But again, these kinds of questions about what happens when you start varying the initialization in an interesting way with respect to the dynamics, I think this is completely open.
There's no simplification when you let p goes to infinity. I don't remember how the spin behaves.
But when p goes to infinity, this would be RAM.
Yeah, but right. then you said your results were just dependent on k and not on p.
Ah, so well, p goes to infinity on the sphere, I think things get a little funky because
so
the RAM on the sphere is a very bad stochastic.
Yeah. There's no
use. Goes to infinity if you keep the ground state fixed.
Yeah, so there's no simplification if you.
No, I mean the whole point is that the whole thing is essentially, it's in some sense trying to develop a perturbation theory about the simpler, you know, trajectory, and then the whole thing is that, you know, the perturbation theory is actually not so. You can actually, the point is that when you're trying to develop a perturbation theory, it actually might be helpful to choose better kinds of initialization. That's sort of the kind of point we're making here, and the question is how do you measure sort of the trade-off between the landscape and the initialization that would make perturbation theory work well in your analysis?
Okay, thank you.